The next case is 03-1175, State of Ohio versus Iron Mayfield. Mr. Ebaker.
Good morning. To start, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time.
Leave the court. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is John Ebaker of the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, and I'm here today representing the State of Ohio appellant in this case, and we've presented two issues for this court to review. The first issue is whether or not the 8th District erred in dismissing the state's appeal without reaching the decision on the merits. Secondly, the second issue for review is whether the trial court erred in finding defendant not guilty upon his entering of a no contest plea.
Counsel, I went over the transcript of the hearing. I just want to make sure I didn't miss anything. The plea is taken, all the Rule 11 questions are asked. The judge actually accepts the guilty plea, is that correct?
Yes.
The judge, he said, I accept the guilty, or she, was it a female judge or?
Male.
Judge said, I accept the guilty plea. Then the attorney gives Mayfield's position. He asks a couple questions of the wife, who, as is typical in these domestic violence cases, now denies anything happened.
Right.
And then the judge just simply states, I find you not guilty.
Yes.
That never asked the state any opportunity to respond, to challenge, to cross-examine, to do anything. The judge just simply said, I find you not guilty, after accepting the guilty plea. Is that correct?
That's correct, and there's two points I want to add to that statement regarding the facts of this case. First of all, I think it's important to note there's no sworn testimony. The victim in this case was not sworn and presented as a witness to present evidence in this case. She was merely asked to speak by the judge after the acceptance of the guilty plea.
And you have a written statement from her that directly contradicts that unsworn statement in court, do you not?
Yes, she signed the police form stating the facts that were recited by the prosecutor.
Counsel, I'm having trouble understanding your statement that this defendant made a guilty plea. The record reflects he made a no contest plea. He made that plea from the start. The whole transcript, I've read the transcript too. It's not very long.
No.
He also talks about he called the police first, which didn't seem to make it into your statement of facts. What are you talking about a guilty plea for?
I misspoke, Your Honor, and I apologize for that.
You sure did. That's a big difference.
I understand that. And I apologize for that. But there was no sworn testimony by the victim in this case. The prosecutor read into in her statement of the state's view of the case.
Is sworn testimony required on a no contest plea?
No. And the point that I would like to present to the court is all we're asking is for a full and fair opportunity to prosecute our case. And I think the timing of this case is significant. We were...
Again, you say prosecuted. You mean appeal your case.
Both. Appeal and prosecute. And I think my statement goes to both issues. The state really was caught in a bind here. They're there at court. And defendant indicates, I want to plead no contest. Okay, and the defendant pleads no contest. Under this court's admonition in Byrd, all we have to look for is whether the facts in the indictment are sufficient. The defendant concedes in his brief that the facts of the indictment did allege a sufficient crime for domestic violence in this case. So upon the when we learned that there was going to be a no contest plea, the state, is, as this court has instructed, is relieved of its burden of proof of having to prove its case. The state didn't bring in any witnesses. We didn't bring in the custodian from the municipal court to bring into evidence the prior conviction. They could have brought in any other witnesses that they may feel necessary to prosecute a domestic violence case. Once there's a no contest plea, under the holding of Byrd, we're relieved of our burden of proof if the indictment is sufficient.
Well, doesn't the no contest plea mean that the defendant is agreeing to the facts that are laid before the court?
Exactly.
Not to the guilt of the crime that is alleged. It
right.
is merely a no contest to the facts.
Yes.
Not that these facts constitute a crime. And then it is up to the trier of fact to determine whether the facts presented, uncontested, are in fact the elements of a crime.
I would say that the language in Byrd from this court said, when there's a no contest plea, the trial court, and this court used the word must, find defendant guilty if the language of the indictment is sufficient. In this case, they concede the language of the indictment was sufficient. Therefore, as this court held in Byrd, the trial court must find defendant guilty. But if I may, I understand the quandary that the trial judge was placed in this case. He's presented with a no contest plea. The victim comes in, as is not uncommon in a domestic violence case, and says it didn't happen. What we've argued is in this situation, if the court is concerned about the situation, about whether or not a crime is concerned, we feel the fair and just resolution would be to enter a plea of no contest. Neither side is prejudiced.
Do you mean not guilty?
A plea,
no contest.
I'm sorry, a plea of
yeah,
not.
Yeah, we need to make, because
I'm sorry.
This is Justice Piper said, that's a different, there is a difference
I
here.
Understand.
That's one of the issues.
I understand, Your Honor, I apologize.
No, but not guilty.
Enter a plea
of not guilty.
Enter a plea of not guilty. That way, like in this situation is a good example. The state can step back, talk to the victim who's now said it didn't happen, look at what other evidence we may have. It's not uncommon for the state to prosecute a domestic violence case if the victim backtracks from their initial statement. So if the trial judge entered a plea of not guilty, then nobody's prejudiced. We go back to square one, and we can determine whether the state's going to continue to prosecute.
Who has the opportunity, or who has that choice on what type of plea, not guilty or no contest?
I'm saying that the trial court, I'm saying in this situation, when there's a no contest plea, I would advocate, I'm advocating that, there's three options available to the trial judge. They could find the defendant guilty, or they could find the defendant enter a plea of no contest, or enter a plea of not guilty, and then—
All right, let's back up here. The defendant is before the court.
Yes.
What are the options available to the defendant?
He pleads, he has already entered at his arraignment, he pled not guilty.
Correct. Now
okay.
We're here before the trial court.
And he pleads no contest. He's
which is his call, the defendant's call,
yeah.
based on conversing with
sure.
the attorney, to enter a no contest plea. It's not up to the prosecutor to say, we agree that you're allowed to enter a no contest
right.
plea. It's the right of the defendant to come forward and plea not guilty, guilty, or no contest,
right.
correct?
Yes.
Okay, so the prosecutor really has nothing to say about it.
No, and I think it highlights the problem that we could be faced here is the prosecution can be taken out of the loop and presented and prejudiced from being able to prosecute its case in this situation because—
Well, wait, back up now. You're asking us to impinge upon the defendant's right to plead no contest because you as a prosecutor got sandbagged maybe by the recantation of the victim.
I would disagree. I'm not asking to impinge on the right to plead no contest. The defendant pleads no contest. The trial court could find the defendant guilty.
Or not guilty, as yes. was done here.
I disagree under Byrd, because Byrd has said if the facts are sufficient, if the indictment is sufficient to allege a crime, which they've conceded in their brief on page 6, then the trial court, and the language from Byrd says must, find the defendant guilty.
It seems to me your argument really is that having gone through the Rule 11 questions, having accepted the no contest plea and finding him guilty, then the court turned around and sort of conducted a mini trial without any sworn testimony or any right of cross-examination, no right to confront the witness with the statement she'd given the police that was the opposite of what she was now saying. And so the court went through this little quick, unsworn kind of mini trial and then turned around and made an opposite finding that the court had already made based on the facts presented by the prosecution. And my understanding in no contest pleas is you take the facts from the prosecution, and that's what the defendant in no contest has agreed the court can accept as true. But then the court took a step beyond that and said, okay, but are they true or not? Let me hear some testimony. And that seems to be what your argument is it not?
Exactly. And
well, counsel?
Can you let him answer the question, please?
Yeah.
Let him answer the question.
Okay. The point, I agree with the court that, with Justice Stratton, that A, we're not allowed to, we can't cross-examine that witness. There can't be a full development of facts. We're not even permitted to, it's the intent of a no contest plea and colloquy is not for the state to prosecute its case and present evidence. It's relieved of its burden of proof upon a no contest plea. So in this situation, by the court finding defendant not guilty, it's really, you know, ambush the state.
You're not contending that the judge in a no contest plea does not have the right to make a finding of not guilty?
Well,
let's just answer that question.
Okay.
Generally, in a no contest plea, you rely upon either the affidavit or the indictment, and the court looks at it and determines whether all the elements are set forth, et cetera.
Absolutely. The judge's role is to determine whether the indictment alleges sufficient facts to constitute
a crime. And so a judge does have the right to make a finding of not guilty on a no contest plea.
If the indictment is insufficient, I would say yes.
Counsel, is it your contention, as Justice Stratton has twice said now, the judge found him guilty and then found him not guilty? When did the judge find him guilty?
No, the judge found him not guilty.
And he never found him guilty?
No.
All right. Now, how do you get around 294567?
Well, in 294567, the statute talks about the state being may appeal any other decision with leave of court. We sought leave of court, and in our motion for leave to the 8th District, which they granted, we tried to make it very clear to the court that we were not trying to backdoor an appeal an acquittal or get a backdoor review of the acquittal, but
and
rather,
they found you were.
What?
And they found, they concluded you were.
And I respectfully disagree with the 8th District in that was my appeal. But and in fact, the 8th District talked about in paragraph 2 that the parties, they heard evidence from both parties. There was no hearing of evidence from the parties in this case. And so what our argument is that we're not appealing the acquittal or the finding of not guilty of Mr. Mayfield. What we're appealing is the legal determination of what the judge did that faced with this no contest plea under Burke.
I read that in your brief, and I have that sounds like dancing on the head of a pin to me. The statute also, the leave of court doesn't refer to final verdict, does it? The statute reads it may appeal by leave of court, the prosecutor may appeal by leave of court to which the appeal is taken, any other decision except the final verdict of the trial court. So there's no, the court doesn't, the way the statute's written, if we apply the plain words, the final verdict is not appealable by the prosecutor, which is the reason you're urging us to agree with you that this is not a final verdict. Is that right?
But I'm not saying that Judge Suster, you know, was wrong or was his determination of whether or not what the facts, you know, or what was stated of the unsworn testimony constituted domestic violence or not. I'm just saying when he was faced with a situation where the indictment is sufficient under the clear language, I'm sorry to keep going back to it, but under the clear language of this court's holding in Byrd, there's a finding of guilty that he must make. And that's the legal ruling that I'm saying he violated this court's holding in Byrd, that rule of law, and that's the issue that we appealed. And if I may, at the end, the 8th District decision talks about putting defendant in double jeopardy. And this court in Keaton specifically has allowed issues to appeal and allow the appeals to be prosecuted, even though there may be a double jeopardy bar down the road. I'm not conceding that there is a double jeopardy bar.
So,
I think,
Counselor, going back then, what you would like this court to state, probably in no uncertain terms, is that once a no-contest plea is entered, there is no additional testimony to be elicited by the court from the defendant and proceed then based on the indictment. Is
sure.
that?
And that's what this court has held in Ex Rel Masseo and in Byrd. It doesn't, in Masseo, they didn't allow affirmative defenses to be brought in. The state has said, this court has said, we're relieved of our burden of proof. So there's nothing for us to do when if the facts of the if the language of the indictment is sufficient, this court in no uncertain terms said must find defendant guilty.
All right, then it's inopposite for the defense then to be able to put forth evidence that would contradict the contents of the indictment. So well, just procedurally is what you're asking us to address.
And if the defendant feels there's facts that contradict. Well,
then it's not a true no contest.
Yeah, don't plead no contest. But by no contest, by Criminal Rule 11b2 says you're admitting to the truth that the state's alleging.
So if the indictment says that Mr. X committed murder and he pleads no contest to that charge, and it's later determined that the victim didn't die, what happens?
And that's what I'm saying. There can be, I understand, as that's a good example. In that situation, I think that when the court is faced with a situation like that, a proper recourse would be to enter a plea of not guilty, and then everybody can go forward from there. That's what the First District and the Eighth District had held in Cohen and Thorpe, that that may be a solution to that problem of that situation where there is a problem, and you can do that. That way, we're not enter a plea of not guilty as opposed to what the court did here, a finding of not guilty.
Let me ask you, it seems to me that the issue that Justice Piper raised is the threshold issue here, whether there can be an appeal by the prosecutor when there's a final verdict, albeit maybe an incorrect verdict by the trial court. If we decide this was a verdict under point 67, how do you get to appeal? Well, if we decide that you may not appeal, do we need to write on anything else? Should we write on anything else? Would it be just advisory?
Under the principle of an error that's capable of review and yet evades, capable of repetition yet evading review, you could have a situation where if this court finds that what happened in this situation is wrong, if we're not allowed to appeal, we can never enforce State versus Byrd. We can never enforce this court's holding in that situation if we're not allowed to appeal. If we can't appeal, we could be, and I'm not saying there's going to be a landslide of this happening, but the point is, if we come to court thinking there's a no contest plea and we're not prepared, there's no reason for us to present any evidence because it's not a trial, and the court enters findings of not guilty, then and we can't appeal, the state is stuck, and the law should not prohibit the state from pursuing legal redress.
You've used your time, Mr. Epker. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Rank.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Kay Ranky, and I represent the appellee in this case, Irene Mayfield. And I respectfully disagree with the position of the state, obviously, and I ask you to uphold the decision of both the 8th District and the trial court.
Counsel, were you trial counsel at...
I was, Your Honor.
Okay.
I've represented Mr. Mayfield at all levels.
I'm going to read what the court said because we have some confusion over guilty and no contest. The court said, I will accept your plea of no contest, and I do find it was voluntarily and knowingly made after fully advising you of your constitutional rights, and it reflects your plea according to a felony of the fifth degree. What do you understand that meant when the court said that?
I think he meant the Rule 11 colloquy as to understanding the purpose of plea, having sound mind. And I think that's what the judgment in this case. He did not find him guilty at any point in time. He accepted the no contest plea.
And what was your client pleading no contest to? The facts that were alleged in the indictment?
That is the purpose of a no contest plea. I can see that.
Then why was the judge then able to go beyond the facts that were given to the judge as alleged in the indictment and start questioning your client and your client's wife as if you had a mini trial when that no contest plea was already accepted?
Well, first of all, the trial court always reserves the right to determine whether or not the facts as alleged are tantamount to a guilty, whether a crime occurred. So the trial court became that.
But should the trial court be allowed to do that without the state having a full ability to cross-examine?
Well, I think your case law, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think the case law on this point says that the court does not have to, but it doesn't say you cannot. It does not say, in none of the cases cited in my brief or by the appellant, does it say you cannot entertain a recitation of facts. It just says you don't have to. And in this case, the trial court did. And I think the case law also says that the defendant's statements cannot factually challenge. We cannot, you know,
except that
attack.
However,
they have to be determined in mitigation.
That you did challenge.
Those would have been determined in mitigation. This case doesn't hinge upon what Mr. Mayfield said. This case hinges upon what Mrs. Mayfield said. And with all due respect, in connection with one of your questions, you indicated that somehow this is what happens in all domestic violence cases. And I think that the record is clear that the prosecution, first of all, did not object. They did not object to the entertaining of statements by Mr. Mayfield or the court's question of Mrs. Mayfield. And that, I believe, is a waiver. And I believe that they have waived their right to raise that appeal. I was going to ask
that question if the prosecutor, when they heard the court questioning these witnesses, if they asked continuance or anything like that. They
did not object in any way, either prior or after. And moreover, the prosecutor on its own said, Betsy Mayfield and Irene Mayfield are no longer living together. She has advised me. It is my understanding, speaking with her today, they have little or no contact. So this is not somehow a case. The record is clear that you can think that the victim just later changed her mind. This is a recantation of the facts by the victim. And Thorpe, although I agree with the proposition that Thorpe says you should accept and find the person guilty after no contest plea, however, Thorpe says unless, the only exception is when a representation is made and negates a factual allegation. What more negation can you have than a person saying, he did not touch me, he did not hit me, Irene is no threat to me, he didn't harm me in any kind of way, in fact, he left. That is a full recantation. That's not just simply some kind of changing. And I believe that if you go to the argument that the trial court is wrong, which is their second proposition, this is exactly what Thorpe said. This is an exception because the facts that are before the court negate the very essential elements of the crime as charged. And secondly,
Counselor, how can you have it both ways?
How can I have it both ways?
How can you have a defendant stand there and say no contest to the facts that are alleged in the indictment, and then, based on your request of in the transcript, ask to put on evidence?
I don't believe I asked to be heard in mitigation. I simply said we were set for trial that day. This wasn't just some kind of pretrial that happened to have.
Is mitigation disputing the facts that you just pled no contest to?
Well, I don't think it's uncommon if you've ever reviewed, and I know you have, where a defendant says, even though they're pleading, entering a plea of no contest, that they say a lot of things in mitigation. I didn't hurt her. I didn't touch her. He, in essence, laid out in his admission, in his colloquy, as to an argument that ensued, what was the basis of the argument, and that corroborated in some way the police statement, which was a misdemeanor, I believe, as it was signed, a complaint, which is important only because, obviously, in a misdemeanor case, the court could do exactly by statute what it did.
Do you see any difference between the plea of no contest, which your client entered, in a different scenario where your client would plead not guilty, waive a jury, and then permit Mrs. Mayfield to make the statement she did in open court?
We could have asked for a bench trial, waived a jury, and put on evidence. That was not the purpose.
My question is, do you see any difference between conducting a bench trial with Mrs. Mayfield as the witness and the proceeding of entering a no contest plea, which was done here?
I see the difference in that I didn't have the ability to cross-examine Mrs. Mayfield in any way. The court simply asked her questions, and she made a statement. So it was not the taking of evidence or cross-examination.
Pardon me, go ahead.
I think the essence of a trial is that the state and the counsel both have the right to inquire and cross-examine the witnesses.
Well,
so I think
if
that's
you had
decision.
Entered a plea of not guilty and then permitted the court to make the finding of not guilty based on Mrs. Mayfield's testimony, I don't know that we would be here. Seems to me the difficulty we have is that because your client pled no contest, he has admitted the truth of the allegations that were contained in the indictment, which are sufficient for the court to make a finding of guilt.
I agree, that is why we're here.
Isn't that a principal difference?
That is a principal, well, I mean, I think the issue is whether or not a no contest is, in fact, a admission of the truth of the facts. What is different?
You think it is not?
It is. No, I think it is, and I think
well,
the case law is clear.
Wait a minute. The record speaks differently. You say, at this time, he is willing to withdraw his plea of not guilty and enter a plea of no contest. And rather than consent to a finding of guilt, however, Your Honor, we would ask for a brief recitation of the facts and the testimony to the court on the issue of guilt. You asked for that.
I did, and I did ask that the court entertain facts.
And the prosecutor didn't object at that
point. Did not object, either at that point or later when they were taking the statements,
Counsel,
for lack of a better
this,
term.
This record is so short that we've apparently all had a chance to read it.
Memorize it.
It seemed to me in reading it that the principal thing your client wanted to get across is that he called the police first, and my understanding is that he wanted to go out and get some property. Was that part of what was going on here?
Well, I think what was read, and I'm not sure because obviously I've argued this case and I defended him, and we were prepared to go to trial that day, but I think what was going on was they were splitting up, and he had called the police and asked for the police to come to help them separate the property because he was moving and taking things. And then sometime in that process, after he called, while they were waiting for the police, she then went and called the police. And so that was kind of the background, and then made statements. And again, you know, you can question what her motives were at the time in court. You can also question, obviously, if you're taking a hindsight approach as to what her motives were in making the statement to begin with. There was no harm in this case whatsoever, other than the statements that she made at the time saying that he made threats. There was no evidence of harm. And I think that was obviously an important factor relied upon by the judge once the victim recanted. But
okay. How does the prosecution have the right to appeal here?
I don't believe they do. I don't believe no matter how carefully crafted your argument is, or worded artfully, I believe that this is another thinly veiled attack on that final verdict, and I believe that it is statutorily precluded. I don't believe this is a question of an evidentiary ruling. You've considered those kind of cases where there's an expert testimony that was allowed, and you've indicated that that was an evidentiary ruling, one of the cases where, I believe it's Lomax, where you indicate, or the trial court and the appellate court considered a situation where there was an attempt to amend the indictment after finding him not guilty. I think I cite that in my brief. That was, again, a collateral attack. This is a final verdict. Keaton says that Rule 29, a directed verdict, 29A, is a final verdict. Can't be appealed by the state. It's a final verdict.
The statute does seem to say that, as you argue. That would mean, I guess, that if a trial court makes an error in law in rendering a verdict that is against the prosecution, that there are no circumstances under which the prosecution could appeal under. This is the first issue you both should have argued. It's the threshold issue. I mean, it's whether the Court of Appeals was correct in saying we don't have jurisdiction to hear the appeal. Now, this is the most important issue of the case to me.
I agree with you. I agree
so
with you.
So are there exceptions?
Or no,
should there
I don't
be exceptions?
Believe there are.
Where,
I mean, I think,
let me ask the question.
I'm sorry.
Should there be exceptions to point 67 to permit the Court of Appeals to accept an appeal where there's a not where the jury has decided, you know, you're correct and you're not correct and who wins and loses, but there's an error of law. How do we get an error of law that the prosecution is urging before an appellate court under 67? Is there a way to do that, do you think, or?
I don't believe so. I mean, in essence, this case is an appeal of the final verdict. No matter what they say about the ruling, they're appealing the finding of not guilty, and that is the final verdict. So I don't know how you get around that. And I think that what they're challenging is two well-settled principles. One is that you cannot factually, statutorily precluded appeal a final verdict. You've decided that many times. All courts have, no matter what, if it's a Rule 29C, Rule 29A, all of those things, it's clear. Secondly, it's an advisory opinion.
There's a hardship under the statute. The General Assembly can change the statute.
That's exactly right. And I think they need to make a statutory exception. This is an issue of double jeopardy, despite, you know, they conceded in their original brief that their statutory precluded.
We don't even need to get to double jeopardy. I mean,
don't
we
even
look
need
at
to
the
get
statute
to
and decide whether the prosecutor has the right to appeal the judgment of the trial court here.
The legislation should change.
I mean, we don't need to get all this other stuff about what happened in the trial court, and it seems to me, in deciding that issue. Now, if we go beyond that and say there was a right to appeal, then, of course, it seems we have to get to the other issues.
If I may, Your Honor, if I may just say one thing, I think the Eighth District was right. They refused to hear the appeal. They said they were without jurisdiction because the state was precluded. It was not a proper appeal. One thing I want to make clear is that the state argues in its briefs that the appellate court found the trial court's decision erroneously based. They did not. The appellate court, if you read the decision, the Eighth District made no finding whatsoever in citing a case in Ray Lee, and then which subsequently cited State versus Gennard, I believe. They said where a trial court, even though erroneously based, cannot be appealed. And that was not finding that in this case the trial court was erroneously based. They just said, worst case scenario, it can't be appealed. And I think that is ultimately what made the Eighth District Court right, and I ask you to affirm it. I think that this case is unusual facts. I don't believe the other reason that the state argues that this is a case that's going to repeat itself and leaves them without redress. I can't imagine a case so unique in that a victim recanting on the record in front of everyone without any objection. And I think that coupled with the facts of this case, make it the reason why that you should uphold.
Counselor,
the
I think
verdicts.
The actual result of this case is that the prosecuting attorney's office in Cuyahoga County will be loath to proceed with no contest pleas, or will certainly change their courtroom behavior as a result of what you did here in this case in attempting to circumvent the facts in the indictment?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, obviously I'm trial counsel, so I'm going to jump to my own defense. But I just would like to say that, and I mentioned in my brief, that it is equally, the state is equally obligated to find out whether the facts are true or not, disclose any exculpatory material prior to that point. The state is in an infinitely better position to discuss the facts, whether true or not, and what their position is on the day of trial. It wasn't my witness. I didn't sandbag them in connection with having the victim come there, who are not living with my client, the record is clear, and say, by the way, he didn't do it. That was their witness, not mine. So I don't really believe that in terms of this case that we did anything to preclude the rights of the state in any way or prevent them from presenting their facts to a neutral fact finder. However, I do think that this case does serve as a lesson about what to do in cases. And I think that the trial court should maybe have listened and said maybe it's a better practice not to find a not guilty, but to refuse to take the plea. But when you have a recantation, what more substantive right than can you find and find somebody not guilty when you have a complete recantation of the facts? So I think it's that unusual fact pattern in this case, as opposed to something that precludes the state or prevents them from the prosecution of their cases.
So you had no idea that Mrs. Mayfield was going to come forward and talk the way she did on the record?
I had no idea. I'd never even met her. Not that that's in the record, but I had never met her or spoken to her at any point in time.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Rankin.
Thank you.
Mr. Abker, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Very briefly, Your Honor. In terms of whether or not we can appeal this, We have to be allowed to appeal this case. If under State versus Byrd, we have a rule of law under Byrd, if the trial court violates this, if we can't appeal that the violation of State versus Byrd, we have a rule of law from this court that a trial court can ignore and we can't appeal. This court has, this isn't the way our judicial system works. If we see the trial court erred, the state is entitled to a full and fair opportunity to present its case.
It should have been done at the earliest possible opportunity. Right when the defense attorney said we're not conceding guilt, we would like to hear evidence. Shouldn't the prosecutor have done something at that point?
Under our understanding of Criminal Rule 11B, when there's a plea of no contest, it's not a trial. We're not there with witnesses prepared to rebut or prepared to cross examine. The trial.
Were you there?
No.
Okay.
I was not there, Your Honor.
Would it have been appropriate for the trial court to urge a change in the plea to not guilty? That's really what happened. This happens, as you know, better than I, that in these domestic violence cases, oftentimes or sometimes the victim changes their story, and which is exactly what happened here. And we want to make sure we don't write bad law because of this one case that where it seems as if perhaps the trial judge could have avoided this problem by simply seeing that the victim had changed her story, apparently, and so perhaps it should be converted to a not guilty plea instead of a no contest plea.
And that's exactly the point why I cited State versus Cohen and State versus Thorpe, two older appellate cases. That way, our rights aren't prejudiced. We can still proceed on this case, whether or not it's a guilt. It's whether or not we can still prosecute it. What the trial court did here in this case precluded us our opportunity to pursue this case, whether or not we.
Ms. Ranke says it was your witness who did it. She's the one who recanted. It wasn't her witness. It was yours.
Frankly, I disagree. There was a witness. It was not. We weren't presenting evidence at that time.
Well, it was the alleged victim.
Yes, it was the victim that said that.
Whom she says she never met.
I understand. And before, first she says there was contact, then she says there was no hitting. But it's not unheard of for the state to pursue a domestic violence charge with the victim, you know, saying it didn't happen. We may have wanted that opportunity in this case. But if there was an entering of a plea of not guilty, we could evaluate and determine what we want to do. By the trial court's finding not guilty, it took away our opportunity to.
Counsel, we've all listened patiently. It seems to me this case, the judge looked at it and recognized, whether it wasn't under oath or whatever, your case was a dead horse. And now you're clear up here in the Supreme Court trying to get us to write something that can potentially mess up every other no contest plea. I don't understand why you're pursuing this.
Well, frankly, Your Honor, we were precluded from the opportunity to pursue this case. There was no opportunity for us to present any other evidence we may have. We could have brought in a 911 tape. I'm not saying this was the best.
But you didn't even ask for a continuance. You didn't even say to the judge, you know, we're surprised by the victim's testimony. We would like some time to speak with her. Nothing like that was done in the trial court.
Admittedly, yes, Your Honor, but the transcript.
And you're still faced with 0.67 that you can't appeal a final verdict.
But since second does
we
say.
We would have to rewrite that law.
No, 6.7 allows for it with may appeal any other ruling. In Keaton, there was an acquittal, and this court allowed the appeal of the prior evidentiary ruling. It does allow for that. You're not having to rewrite 6.7.
An evidentiary ruling. You are appealing a final verdict.
6.7, any other rule of law. This court announced a rule of law in Byrd. We feel it was violated. How do we pursue our appellate rights? And the state does have appellate rights. How do we pursue a violation of a clear dictate from this court?
Well, wouldn't you protect the record to allow for that by objection at the time when Mr. Mayfield opened his mouth to dispute the facts that you thought were undisputed? And you protect yourselves and then, quite frankly, or potentially, an appeal if that's countermanded.
Sure. But
But it didn't happen here.
No.
And now you want us to rewrite or interpret the statute that not only has a ramification on your case, mm-hmm. but allows the door open for prosecutors to appeal every verdict that goes against them.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not asking this court to rewrite it to allow the state to appeal verdicts in this case. We're not asking this court to change the fundamental law of the state. All we're asking for is the ability to pursue a legal wrong that we saw. That's all we're asking. The court.
What exactly are you appealing? The verdict or?
No, the trial court's decision to find the, to, once there was a no, once there was a no contest plea, and the facts and the indictment was sufficient
right.
to not, under Byrd, find the defendant guilty. As this court said,
which is
it must.
The verdict. The finding of the court is the verdict. So
but
how,
it was the decision to do that. I mean,
the decision to do that, there was no motion, there was no objection to a motion, there was no procedure.
I understand that.
Okay. Thank you.
You've used your time. Thank you, Mr. Epker. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.